You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, following a devastating earthquake and subsequent cholera epidemic, the impoverished island nation of Haiti is now trying to lure back tourist dollars. The question is, would you go? We'll chat with someone who just got back and thinks the plan has a few wrinkles. We'll also take a tour of the world of film animation.
Das ist Norman Babcock. Seine Familie ist ein kleines bisschen nervig.
Norman!
Kannst du nicht so sein wie andere Kinder in deinem Alter?
Du sagst doch immer, andere in meinem Alter würden nur Läden ausrauben und in der Gegend rumlungern.
And that was a taste of what you might hear at this year's Fantosh Animation Festival underway in Switzerland. The artistic director of the festival will join us live. And later in the show, Jeremy Seal, author and lover of all things Turkish, travelled along the country's Meander River for 500 kilometres and wrote a book about his experiences. He'll join us in a bit. We'll also pop by another of Midori House's neighbours. Today, we'll meet the innovation firm What If and see one of their curious bovine staff members.
We have a Spider-Man cow. There used to be a Superman cow here as well. And then when we started the New York office, the super cow was sent abroad. So he's kind of in exile now and he's in our New York office. I've seen him there.
Okay. And we'll also get a roundup of the week's top stories with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve, what can we look forward to today?
I'll give you three guesses. Actually, no, I'll give you one guess. It's Obama. We're going to talk about Obama. And I'll also tell you everything you could possibly want to know about Eurobonds.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to that. All that, plus we play some rather good music too, all to come in the next hour on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Investigators in France say a possible family dispute over money is one line of inquiry into the killings of four people in the Alps. Three members of a UK family named as Saad Al-Hilli from Claygate in Surrey, plus his wife and mother-in-law, were shot dead near Lake Annecy on Wednesday. A French cyclist thought to have been a witness was found shot dead nearby. The French president, François Hollande, described the killings as a horrible tragedy and promised that everything possible would be done to find those responsible. The head of the International Committee for the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, has said that any optimism extracted from his meeting with Bashar al-Assad in Syria should be met with a realist tone and results. Speaking at his first news conference after returning from Syria, Mr. Maurer said he had managed to extract commitments from President Bashar al-Assad after positive talks in Damascus. He warned that there was still cause to think things could change for those suffering in the Syrian crisis.
What makes me think that we are in a different situation, because I had the impression, as I mentioned before, that the representatives of the Syrian government are today aware that there is a crisis, that people are in need, and that they have to do something to allow aid to suffering populations.
In other developments, Syrian forces have bombarded a crowded Palestinian refugee district in Damascus, killing at least 10 people, while other parts of the city have been rocked by apparent rebel bomb attacks. The main focus of the fighting is now in the economic centre Aleppo, but rebels fighting to topple President Assad continue to attack government forces and buildings in the capital. Barack Obama has been asking for a second term as US president, with a pledge to keep rebuilding a battered economy in a way that may be harder but would lead to a better place. Mr. Obama said the election between him and Republican Party nominee Mitt Romney would have profound consequences on jobs. Britain's Prince Harry has arrived at Camp Bastion in Afghanistan's Helmand province to start an operational tour as an Apache helicopter commander. The prince is to be working as part of the Joint Aviation Group, which provides helicopter support to the International Security and Assistance Force and Afghan forces operating throughout the region. At least 43 people have been killed and 150 more injured by a series of earthquakes in southwest China. The quakes, the strongest of which measured 5.6, struck shortly after 11 a.m. local time on the border between Yunnan and Guizhou provinces. Lufthansa's striking cabin crew have continued their protest, saying they're ready to talk as the German carrier is forced to cancel 1,200 flights. leaving an estimated 100,000 passengers stranded. Staging protests in front of the airports in Frankfurt and Munich, amongst others, cabin crew members, including René Gerant, made clear their frustration at the current Lufthansa management.
And now our working conditions are really tough already. Sometimes we hardly have any days off, you know, you just come home to unpack your suitcase, to wash your clothes, to maybe see your family for a day or two, and then you have to pack again and go, and this should be getting worse if we don't strike here, and we're not willing to do this anymore.
Friday marks the third day of strikes in the dispute, which has led to Lufthansa cancelling hundreds of flights at a cost of more than 10 million euros. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, James. It's 18.05 here at Midori House in London, which means it's 13.05 in New York and 17.05 in Paris. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
The proper Jalabert, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, the week's almost at an end, and there's a new segment which we started last week with Tyler Brulé, who's our editor-in-chief. Each Friday at this point in Midori House, we're going to look back over the week at some of the major events that have kind of shaped the week and probably will shape the weeks to come. And there's no doubt that there's kind of been one thing that's really kind of dominated the news headlines here at Monocle 24 and elsewhere around the world, and that's obviously the Democratic Party Convention. And I'm joined now in the studio by Steve Bloomfield, who's a foreign editor and who's been watching events. And I know earlier on today, Steve, you were talking to Sasha Isenberg, who's our Washington correspondent.
I was.
And let's look back over that week. What do you think has been the achievement of the week? Do you think that, well, the key thing, I guess there are two key things that Obama wanted to do. He wanted to clean up his reputation, present himself as the man of the moment, and somehow kind of get rid of some of the... I think he was encumbered by all the speeches he's made over the years that have been amazing, but somehow haven't quite delivered. So it was kind of a switching of gears slightly, wasn't it?
I think the key thing for Democrats this week was to work out what they wanted the election to be about and to try and make that case. And they've been umming and ahhing over the last few months about how they're going to portray Romney. Do you say that he is a hard right ideologue in hock to the Tea Party who is going to, you know, cut taxes for the rich and cut Medicare for everyone else? Or do you say he's a flip-flopper who doesn't really know where he is? And they tried to do both those things for a while. They've chosen pretty carefully now. They're going to say this man is, you know, on the hard right, you can't trust him. So they've decided that. But the key thing they had to do this week on top of that was to make sure that they presented a positive reason why Barack Obama should be re-elected, not just, oh my God, look at the other guys, they're really scary. And so that involved speeches from Michelle Obama, it involved Bill Clinton the night before last, and then Obama himself last night, trying to say, look, you know, no, things aren't wonderful, but they are much better than they were 4 years ago. We're halfway through a recovery. Re-elect me, and I'll continue to work hard, and we'll have a full recovery. And, you know, his big advantage is that, on the whole, people do tend to like him.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that repositioning. First of all, we're going to hear Michelle Obama, who kind of came, you know, she's more popular than her husband with the country, and she had an interesting job to do. She was trying to explain that her husband was, you know, somebody who was driven by hoping to give everyone the same opportunity. And then straight away afterwards, we'll hear from Bill Clinton and his take on the Obama legacy and the way ahead.
Barack knows the American dream because he's lived it. And he wants everyone in this country, everyone, to have the same opportunity, no matter who we are or where we're from or what we look like or who we love.
He inherited a deeply damaged economy. He put a floor under the crash. He began the long, hard road to recovery and laid the foundation for a modern, more well-balanced economy that will produce millions of good new jobs, vibrant new businesses, and lots of new wealth for innovators. Now, are we where we want to be today? No. Is the president satisfied? Of course not. But are we better off than we were when he took office?
Well, that's an amazing speech. I think it lasted almost 45 minutes and a piece of rousing speech making that, you know, it really, you should just listen to it, whatever your politics are, because it was an extraordinary speech. Steve, what did you take from Clinton?
I think we heard both parts of the story there. With Clinton, he was making the case there that, look, we're doing our best, we're halfway through, stick with us, and it's all going to be fine. And then you had the personal case that Michelle Obama was making. And she, you know, that line of saying, he understands the American dream because he's lived it, was incredibly passionate, incredibly good, incredibly partisan as well, because that's also a dig at Romney. This is a man who's worth $200 million, whose dad was the CEO of a big company, who owns horses, who has an elevator for his cars. It makes the point that, you know, you've got a choice between this guy who doesn't understand you, who's out of touch, or my guy who has lived through the American dream, only paid off his student loans 8 years ago. He understands what poverty's like.
It's a very tricky card to play, though, isn't it, in the US politics? Because, in fact, many American people, even if they don't have a huge amount of money, this fantasy of the American dream, but they still believe in it. And so they don't mind people who have a lot of money if they've made it themselves. So it's not always a damning thing, is it, to be rich in American politics?
No, not at all. Far from it. But I think the fact that, you know, equally at the same stage, politicians in America like to claim that they had this sort of very hard upbringing, that life was tough, that, you know, they've sort of made it through and they're only in this position now through sheer force of will. And that's a bit difficult for Romney.
Now, foreign politics doesn't always play very well in a domestic election, especially one in the US. But there was a few things that came up during all the speeches about foreign policy. And this is President Obama talking about his view mainly on the opposition.
They want to take us back to an era of blustering and blundering that cost America so dearly. After all, you don't call Russia our number one enemy, not Al-Qaeda, Russia, unless you're still stuck in a Cold War mind warp. You might not be ready for diplomacy with Beijing if you can't visit the Olympics without insulting our closest ally.
Well, that, I think there's quite a lot of humour coming into that speech as well, because obviously that last line refers to the trip by Romney to the UK when he managed to insult the Brits for not being ready enough for the Olympics, and it turned out we put on a damn good show, so I'm sorry about that. But it's interesting, he was referring there to foreign policy, and that's not really a winning ticket at this point, is it?
It can be to a certain extent. What's interesting here is that traditionally foreign policy has been where the Republicans have felt their strongest, particularly if we're talking about issues of war. And now we're in a situation where actually the Democrats feel it's a far stronger point for them. And you can just imagine what would have happened if George Bush had, Osama bin Laden had been killed while George Bush was in power. It would have made, you know, they would have milked it for all it was worth, perhaps more so than Obama has. One small thing about foreign policy, David Cameron would have been very, very happy listening to that last night, partly because he wants Obama to win, but also because Obama referred to Britain as our closest ally.
And it's also interesting, I guess, you know, talking about foreign policy there, that actually most leaders around the world, when they get kind of entrenched relationships or successful relationships with other incumbents, they don't really always want to see change, even if it's to a party that perhaps you might think is more aligned with their world perspective. You're right. I think, you know, he would like Obama to stay in, wouldn't he?
Yeah, in the same way that actually Tony Blair preferred George W. Bush to John Kerry in 2004. It works both ways.
Now, let's just hear another piece of oration from President Obama, you know, an extraordinary speaker. And this is, I think, where he really kind of, he nails it in his, this is the nub of what he's trying to do. He's trying to say to American people, it's up to you, it's not up to me. You're the people who need to direct this change. And this is him speaking now.
Yes, our path is harder, but it leads to a better place. Yes, our road is longer, but we travel it together. We don't turn back. We leave no one behind. We pull each other up. We draw strength from our victories, and we learn from our mistakes. But we keep our eyes fixed on that distant horizon, knowing that providence is with us.
Now there's a man who's been to church a few times, isn't there? That is like, that's getting you out your pews. It's fascinating again because, you know, when we, even as Europeans, when we listen to that, you engage with it and you believe it and you understand it. But actually, I don't think any British politician could ever stand up, for example, in the UK and do that. Or even I don't think a French politician or an Italian politician, it just doesn't migrate.
No, you're right. It really doesn't. And it's something very particular about great American speakers, whether that's Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, or now Barack Obama, that they, as you say, they have that ability to pull you up out of your seat, and it's something that elsewhere in the world you don't see so much. François Hollande, less so. Julia Gillard, unlikely. Vladimir Putin, oddly, yes, but in a different way.
Yes, I can't quite see him doing the same kind of nuanced speech. I think he might just shout at you and you'd stand up. now, let's do one other look back of the week, because closer to home, well, across Europe, from where we're sitting, the Eurobonds came back. And actually, has something finally been done that could help resolve the situation?
Yes, possibly, but maybe no.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Explain all.
So, Mario Draghi has been trying to find, he's the head of the European Central Bank, has been trying to find a way to act, for the ECB to act more like a central bank does, whether that's the Bank of England here in the UK or whether it's the Federal Reserve in the US, and essentially be the lender of last resort, so that if something goes, in the technical phrasing, tits up, that there is someone there, that the government steps in to say, don't worry, we will sort this out, we will bail you out, we are going to be there for you. And the ECB has been reticent to do this, mainly from the German members of the ECB, the old Bundesbank, because they don't want to end up having to pay for other people's debts. But Mario Draghi, I think, has realised that unless you guarantee some of this debt and you buy it up with new euro bonds, then this thing spirals out of control. The reason I say yes, possibly, maybe no, is because on Wednesday, the Constitutional Court in Germany is going to rule whether the entire bailout mechanism for the EU is actually legal under German law. If they say no, then that's quite difficult, and I don't really know where we go from there.
Well, that's Steve Bloomfield, who's going to become the new economics editor, I think. God, no wonder that you're so good at those expenses claims. That was actually impressive. That was Steve.
That was actually impressive. Thanks, Andrew.
I'm going to take notes. That was Steve Bloomfield, who's our foreign editor. And tune in every Friday at this time, because we're going to be doing a review of the week's big headlines and the things that have shaped the world. We're going to be right back.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Those.
You are cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
On the latest edition, we get some cultural offerings from the Venice Architecture Biennale and test our fortunes with a unique character from the old American fairground.
It's fascinating to see school-aged children just look up and wonder what she's going to say.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
Welcome back, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, the more observant driver cruising down the I-95 expressway in Miami will notice an enormous sign. Live the experience, seize the opportunity, it reads, superimposed on a scene of a white sandy beach. Sponsored by the Haitian consulate in Miami and the country's tourism ministry, the poster site is all part of the country's attempts to woo back visitors and investment to the island following the 2010 catastrophic earthquake. But is tourism really the solution? Joining us on the line now is Anastasia Maloney, who's our correspondent in Bogota, who's been to Haiti three times since the earthquake and was actually just there a few weeks ago. Anastasia, thank you very much for joining us. Let's be blunt. Is tourism a good idea?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think that Haiti is ready to receive tourists at the moment. What I saw last month was still that parts of Port-au-Prince still look like a huge refugee camp. There's still 400,000 people living under tents, bed sheets, scrap metal. Even though a lot of them have now resettled, there's still a lot of people in the capital living in desperate poor conditions. That's just one of the things that the government should concentrate on focusing on and resettling these people rather than luring tourists at the moment.
Now tell me, when you go there, where do you actually stay? Is there a hotel infrastructure? You know, are the likes of the chains already in Port-au-Prince? Where can you stay?
You can stay in, there's several five-star luxury hotels, definitely, and most of them now have been rebuilt after the earthquake. So that's 2.5 years on. Most of them are now up and running fully. It's very hard usually to get a hotel. They're usually booked. But most of the good hotels have their own electricity supply, clean water, swimming pools, and good service, and very pleasant stay, in fact. But it's very hard to get a hotel because they're always packed with aid workers, with UN staff, doing their development work in the country. So you have to book ahead, and it's basically catering for the international aid community. There's not any holidaymakers as such at the moment in Haiti.
Now, pre-earthquake, was there even a tourism industry really then?
Yes, there was. There was some sort of a tourist industry. There were cruise liners that used to do a Caribbean tour, and they stopped at the neighbouring Dominican Republic, and then also in certain beaches in Haiti. So Haiti has been used to that. And also, there's a huge Haitian diaspora. There's millions of Haitians living outside of Haiti, particularly in the United States and Canada. And they often come back for their holidays, for weekends, the summer and Christmas breaks, and they will holiday in their own country. So they were basically generating the tourism. But as far as tourists from abroad looking for a Caribbean destination, it was always the Dominican Republic next door that seemed to grab most of those tourists looking for a sunny break.
Because that's the extraordinary thing, isn't it? You know, Hispaniola, the island that the Dominican Republic and Haiti sit on, Haiti over in the west, divided right down the middle. On one side you have this massive tourism industry, and on the other side you have nothing. On one side you tend to have the chaos and the poverty of Haiti, and on the other side, actually reasonable development going on in the Dominican Republic. Now, a lot of that is cultural, but it is a really extraordinary tale of, you know, two halves of one island, isn't it?
That's right, and it's the contrast is very, very stark, because hunger and poverty is very tangible in Haiti. You can see it. You can see it with the people on the streets, and you can't get away from it. You cannot get away from the grinding poverty. You'll cross over to the border, and Port-au-Prince is only sort of a two-hour drive on actually a fairly good road right into the border to the Dominican Republic, and you'll see a difference immediately. And as you say, the Dominican Republic has a well-established and flourishing tourist industry. The problem with Haiti, it's that it's been a governance issue. For many people say it's been a question of political unrest, bad governments, dictatorships, political instability, and that's been one of the key issues holding back Haiti and developing like its neighbour has.
Now, one of the shocking things, I thought, we sent Ed Stock, a Monocle correspondent who's now based in Buenos Aires, but he went to Haiti not long ago to do a story about the Brazilians who are there as troops helping in Port-au-Prince. But in the background of these pictures, you saw Port-au-Prince and it was not rebuilt. There were still buildings that had collapsed like some bad wedding cake and people trundling all along these terribly muddy roads. It really was a city that just seemed to be begging out for funding and for some help. But obviously, over time, quite a lot of money has gone back in, even over the last year or so, especially from the US. Why is that rebuilding not happening at a greater pace?
The problem with Haiti is that for years, even before the earthquake, it was known as the Republic of NGOs. Every development agency was doing projects there. And it's been years and years of bad and poor coordination between all these agencies, the UN, the EU, the UN peacekeeping force that's on the ground. They've never been able to coordinate. So what happens is that people pour in billions of dollars into Haiti, but it's done in a piecemeal fashion. There doesn't seem to be any integral, coherent development plan. However, I must say that the last time I went, just a few weeks ago, I finally felt that there was some sense of momentum building and that there was a bit of rebuilding, recovery started. The biggest difference from now and 2010 when the earthquake happened is that the rubble has been cleared. Most of it has been cleared. So that's a big difference. And again, the tent cities, even though there's still some and there's an eyesore and it's glaring and you can't miss it, they have been removed from some of the key areas. So in the presidential palace, which is still in ruins, they haven't rebuilt it yet, there used to be hundreds of thousands of people in the main park and the squares camping out. They've all just been recently been resettled. So that visually, it looks different than it just a few months ago, and it's slowly getting up. But the problem is it's the lack of stability in the government, political unrest, with the UN peacekeeping force adding to this mix, along with aid that's badly coordinated, is the story of Haiti, which people are still trying to work out and improve.
Well, Anastasia, I don't think I'll be packing my bucket and spade just yet, but you know, an extraordinary story, and we are going to be following more of what's happening in Haiti, because it's a country that needs a huge amount of assistance, and it's a story that we've been intrigued by here for a long time, how you help a country after such kind of a terrible event. But thanks, Anastasia, for joining us, and you're listening to Midori House. Now, there's lots of very good things coming your way over the next half an hour or so. But first of all, we're going to have a pause, a kind pause. This is Seyou with Lenda. And that was Seyou with Lenda, and Seyou is obviously from Brazil. Well, not I say obviously, but you'll have guessed by that nice Portuguese lilt there. Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we're going to be chatting with Jeremy Seal, who's the author of the new book Meander, East to West Along a Turkish River. We're also going to check in at the Fantosh Animated Film Festival in Switzerland, and we're also going to pop by and meet another one of our neighbours.
We have a Spider-Man cow. There used to be a Superman cow here as well, and then when we started the New York office, the super cow was sent abroad, so he's kind of in exile now, and he's in our New York office. I've seen him there.
That's a load of bullocks that you can expect later on, but first of all, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
Investigators in France say a possible family dispute over money is one line of inquiry into the killings of four people in the Alps. Three members of a UK family named as Sardal Hilly from Claygate in Surrey, his wife and mother-in-law, were shot dead near Lake Annecy on Wednesday. A French cyclist thought to have been a witness was found shot dead nearby. The head of the International Committee for the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, has said that any optimism extracted from his meeting with Bashar al-Assad in Syria should be met with a realist tone and results. Speaking at his first news conference after returning from Syria, Mr. Maurer said he had managed to extract commitments from President Bashar al-Assad after positive talks in Damascus on Tuesday. In other developments, Syrian forces have bombarded a crowded Palestinian refugee district in Damascus, killing at least 10 people, while other parts of the city have been rocked by apparent rebel bomb attacks. Barack Obama has been asking for a second term as US president, with a pledge to keep rebuilding a battered economy in a way that may be harder but would lead to a better place. Mr. Obama said the election between him and Republican Party nominee Mitt Romney would have profound consequences on jobs. And Lufthansa's striking cabin crew have continued their protest, saying they're ready to talk as the German carrier is forced to cancel 1,200 flights, leaving an estimated 100,000 passengers stranded. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, James. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London. Now, the Langrus twisting Menderes River in Turkey is where we get the word meander from. And in fact, just its name was almost enough to attract the attention of the travel writer and Turkophile Jeremy Seal. His new book, Meander, East to West Along a Turkish River, sees him travelling along the artery through ancient history and modern tales. He joins us on the line now to explain why going slowly through Turkey's backwaters appealed so much. Jeremy, thank you for joining us. This is an amazing book, but tell us why you decided that this river was a way of telling the story of both ancient and modern Turkey.
That is a very good question. I suppose because I thought I knew a lot about this country. I'd travelled through it extensively and comprehensively for decades, and had, I suppose, always assumed that if there was a river called the Meander, it didn't exist anymore. And then I came across it one day, quite by chance, when I was driving through rural Turkey, and crossed this bridge, and there it was, a little sign saying the Meander, and I thought, there it is, I didn't know about it, it's the classic twisting slow river, I need to travel down it. So at that moment, which was a few years back, the idea of at some point in the future traveling down this river was born. I was also aware that it was very, very rich in ancient history, and wanted to explore that as well.
And tell me, did meander in some way mean a metaphor? Because it's certainly not a metaphor for contemporary Turkey now, is it? You know, in the years that you've been going there and you've written extensively about the country, are you finding it a much changed nation to write about? You know, let's just explain that the book has a huge amount of ancient history in it, but lots of current characters walk into the scenes chapter by chapter. Are you finding it's really changing at a pace when you go back there?
Yes, I mean, I've been travelling there. I suppose I'm a bit of a veteran. I've been travelling there for the best part of 25 years. It's been changing dramatically, radically over that period of time. Certainly when I was first there in the 80s, there were very few visitors. There was no tourism. And the overall political and cultural scene was very different from what it is now. It's a booming, booming country. Attitudes are changing. And it struck me that one of the best ways of getting to the bottom of what really constitutes Turkish values, Turkish ideas, the Turkish reality, was not to ask direct questions, if you like, but, as you suggested a little bit earlier in this interview, to take a slightly more indirect route. In fact, the route which was prompted and suggested by the river itself. So you're right to say that the river worked in a sense as a kind of metaphor for what I was looking for. Quite difficult answers to quite difficult questions, which I thought might come to me by simply abandoning myself to this twisting, indirect river that was full of digressions in the hope that it would throw up all kinds of answers that perhaps I wasn't expecting.
And what were some of those unexpected things you did discover on the route?
One of the things that was confirmed was just how wonderfully hospitable and kind Turkish people are. So I set out along this river not really knowing what was going to happen to me or where I would be put up, because a quick look at the map told me that there was nothing in the way of hotels along the route I was following. And so it was a case every evening of simply arriving as the sun went down, pulling up my canoe, getting out of the boat and walking to the nearest village. And walking into the nearest village, smelly after a day on the river, not knowing anybody locally, and simply asking if they could put me up. And time and again, without even so much as batting an eyelid, local farmers, local guardians of kind of waterworks or pumping stations or dams, local villagers would make room for me in their houses and feed me and then see me on my way the following morning. And that sort of, I suppose, confirmed to me what I've always loved about this country, which is that there is an extraordinary, extraordinary hospitality, and also a deep-seated interest in the motives and the characters of the strangers who pass through their land.
Well, I think there's two interesting things to pick up there. First of all, culturally, why is it that people in Turkey are so hospitable? I've been there myself and I've seen the same thing. Whereas we know that if you were perhaps in an English village and you kind of knocked on a farmer's door and suggested you sleep in his house, he might see you off with a shotgun.
Indeed. I mean, this this is always extraordinary, isn't it? And it's traditionally been put down to the Muslim tradition, that it's enshrined, if you like, in the values of a good Muslim. That said, there are plenty of other parts of the Muslim world where you can travel and certainly not run into the same levels of hospitality. I'm not sure where the tradition comes from, but I have read these incredible accounts dating back to the 19th century of earlier travelers traveling in Turkey, and this is something that I actually recount in the book, running into spectacular levels of comfort and accommodation. People clearing their houses for travelers, bringing them meals, looking after their horse, bringing them firewood, cleaning their clothes, and then not expecting any money at all. So it's an extraordinary thing, and I don't think you can put this tradition down to any particular single motive or underlying reason. It's just there, and the fact that it's still there now, despite the fact that most Turks are used to modern tourists coming with hire cars and staying in hotels, that this underlying courtesy and kindness still exists.
The other point I decided to bring up, you're talking about this past, the visitors, that your book touches on, you know, the Byzantine era, it touches on the Greek era. Mm. Are the people along the meander, are they aware of how much rich history has taken on around them? And is that something that that feeds their character? Or because sometimes when you go to places which, despite having an incredibly rich history, is almost ignored, or because it doesn't fall in with, you know, say, the Muslim tradition, that it gets a bit ignored.
That's a very good question. They are certainly aware of their history insofar as the fact that it's everywhere around them. So one of the things I've always loved about Turkey is the fact that incredibly old, carved pieces of masonry, which may be two and a half thousand years old, appear casually embedded in the walls of modern farmhouses. So old statuary and masonry is casually recycled into the building. So it's certainly the case that they know there is a lot of old stuff around. But it's also the case that, I guess in any number of parts of the world, levels of education aren't that high, so they won't necessarily distinguish between, say, a Byzantine piece of masonry from the 1200s and a pre-Christian piece of masonry from sort of 2,500 years ago. There's a hell of a lot of very, very complicated history in the Meander Valley, and the relationship of the local farming people, as I suppose you would expect in any farming community, while they tend to use it in a practical sense, while they tend to recycle it for their buildings and things, they won't necessarily understand A, where it comes from, or what its cultural value is.
I'd like to ask you a very different question now. Mm-hmm. What's amazing is that this is 350 pages of beautiful print, a great jacket design, a really nice book. I can see it kind of going off shelves very quickly. Why is it there's still a market for these great pieces of travel writing? You know, in a time when we can all go anywhere, and when in fact, you know, that all the travel guides seem to be vanishing off bookshelves because everything's online and people want TripAdvisor.
Yeah. It's a very good question.
Why have you managed to cling on to this territory?
You know, I'm not sure I have, to be perfectly honest with you. The truth of the matter is that it is certainly a shrinking world. The number of travel writers who are writing full-length travelogues like my own is certainly shrinking. The amount of money we're being paid to do it is certainly shrinking, and the amount of return is certainly shrinking. And I think that it's partly a matter of fashion. If you think back 20, 30 years ago, when the likes of Bruce Chatwin and Eric Newby and Paul Theroux and the rest of them were writing, travel writing was incredibly popular and there was a big market for it. But it certainly seems to be the case now that it's a harder and harder thing to do. A lot of my travel writing contemporaries have actually given it up to write more conventional histories and or biographies. And I just wonder whether that's going to be reversed, and suddenly the reading public is going to rediscover an appetite for this kind of book, or whether, as you say, the same thing that appears to be happening with conventional travel guides is going to continue to happen, i.e. there's going to be less and less of a market for it. There is certainly a difference. If you are looking for the sort of information that you used to get from a travel guide, it's very easy to get it now on an app. That is not the same in terms of the experience I would suggest of reading a travel book like my own. it's certainly a labor of love, and it's the sort of book that if you have an interest in Turkey, you probably couldn't find the information contained in the particular way it is elsewhere. As to whether the market for this kind of book is going to improve, I don't know, because you know, it's a tough thing to do. It requires a lot of work to do it well, and the returns ain't what they used to be.
Well, I would certainly commend anybody listening to pick up a copy of Meander. It's an amazing book, and I think you're right. I think the facts in here can't be Googled. It's not an experience you can find online quickly, and I think there will always be a place for a book like this. But Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us. That was Jeremy Seal, who's the author of the new book Meander, East to West Along a Turkish River. Go and buy a copy. We need to make sure that these people stay in business. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back right after this with a trip to Switzerland.
On Wednesday and Thursday next week, Monocle 24 heads to Helsinki. We'll be sitting down with the tastemakers behind the current world design capital in a city known for its design and architecture with the reputation of good quality of life, efficiency and high tech. It's not just vodka, Santa Claus and reindeer, you see. That's Midori House on Wednesday and Thursday next week, right here on Monocle 24. Kippis ja kuulemiin.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Now, one of the world's most successful animation festivals, Fantosh, is being hosted by the city of Baden, making the city a meeting place for animation specialists from around the world. It's devoted to the full array of animation techniques, and the festival's debut was back in 1995. Joining us on the line now is Annette Schindler, who's the artistic director of the festival. Welcome, Annette. Let's first of all start off with why in Switzerland?
Well, animation is a very lively field, and also in Switzerland people are interested in knowing about what is developing in the field of animation. So we have a Swiss audience, but also we have an international audience, and that both of them are enjoying very much the possibility to see lots of animated movies, from very experimental to also big productions.
And is there a good animation number of studios in Switzerland?
There are a few animation studios. There are also schools where people are educated in learning these techniques. There is a scene of animators here in Switzerland also, but the studios are, of course, not as big as the major studios.
No, sure.
In the United States or so.
And tell me, in the roster of films that you have, what's been interesting, I think, over the last few years is there's been this kind of diversion. There is the kind of animation that comes out of Hollywood, incredibly slick, you know, unbelievable images. And then there's also, which has been very successful, more kind of hand-drawn almost films, where you have a much more sense of the person behind the images. Are you seeing that kind of range of film at your festival?
Yes, we are still seeing a big range of films, and I think it won't break off this this stream of very different modes. We have the old techniques of handcrafted animation with puppets, with drawing, with painting, with cutout techniques, all of them. Then we have them combined also with some very new technologies like 3D printers. Like some big studios are able to use 3D printers to print out puppets that are then moved by hand to be animated. So we have all these combinations. Of course, we have the computer-generated imagery, the CGI, that is adding to the mix. So I don't think it's replacing any other techniques. It's just an additional technique that is now available. And these for me, to my point of view, really still in development. So there are some really, really good works with computer-generated imagery. But I think the subtleties are still to be found out.
Now, Annette, without upsetting too many of the other people there, pick a film for us that you feel has really kind of piqued your interest this time.
Well, one film that really piqued my interest in this selection is, for example, the film Alois Nebel. It's a film from Czech Republic. It's made in a rotoscopy technique, which is a live-action shooting, which is then transformed image by image to animated imagery. And it's a film that plays on the Czech border, the Sudet, Germany history, all taking place in a tiny little train station and kind of reflected in the lives of these people that are there and that trying to cope with the past and building up their own future in this film. So I think it's a really impressive, important film. It's impressive from the technique and it's also meaningful from the story.
And tell me, is it mainly film or are there people making TV shows as well who are coming to your event?
Yes, we do. This year we had a panel discussion with people making TV series. We had some speakers that talked to the filmmakers really very much about giving them advices on how to go about making TV series. It's a field that's in debate here in Switzerland, but also in many other places of what is a good way to go to build up your TV series and to be able to make it produced and to bring it into the TV stations.
And finally, just for people who don't know, what does Fantoche mean?
Fantoche is a reference to one of the pioneers of animation, Eric Cohn. He coined this word and he named his one of his very, very first animated figures, Fantoche. It's kind of a mixture of phantom and fantasy, so it holds both these elements and it's just a important key figure in the history of animation.
Annette, great speaking to you. That was really interesting. That was Annette Schindler, who's the artistic director of Fantoche. Fantoche Dich, I think, is the phrase we're looking for. Thank you very much indeed. And we're going to be back with Meet the Neighbours in just a moment. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, at this point every Friday, we go out, we wander around, we meet one of our neighbours and we stick a microphone in their face to find out what on earth they're up to. And there's one person who I was dispatched to do this task. His name is Fernando and he's been out and about. In fact, I can see he's already snuck down to the other side of the glass because he's so proud of his handiwork. He's met all the neighbours. When you go out with him, people, they wave, they cheer, they give a toot on their car horns. It's here comes Fernando, the Meet the Neighbours guy. Anyway, this is what he did this week. He went out and he met a company called What If. They're an innovation outfit. Now, if you don't know what that means, listen to this. They live around the corner and we spoke to one of their inventors who's called Jonas Twitchen.
My name is Jonas, and I work at What If Innovation. What If is it's a bit like a strategy consultancy, and really all it does is it helps to bring fresh thinking into organisations. And so typically the problem that a lot of big companies face is that their competitors these days are much smaller organisations. And because these organisations are smaller, they're a bit more entrepreneurial, they're a bit more hungry, they're more ready to disrupt markets and do unexpected things and brave things. And big companies are very good at doing what they've always done very well and being efficient. They're not very good at changing direction and taking risks and placing speculative bets or re-engaging with their consumers in a really brave way. And so we help them to kind of be more idea-led and be more innovative and be more entrepreneurial. And that can be through running projects for them or training people or doing conferences or doing kind of hybrid projects and conferences and trying to kind of transform companies to make them work better.
My job at What If is, the title is Inventor, which sounds a bit high blown, and really it is, but I guess an inventor at What If is really just there to kind of take on these very open-ended challenges. So if a company has a marketing problem, we all know that there are marketing consultancies out there to deal with that. If a company has a strategy problem, there are strategy consultancies, you know, big name ones that can deal specifically with that. But a lot of firms these days, they're not really sure what the nature of the problem they face is. And so a lot of our job is to respond to a question which is quite open-ended. And a lot of our job is thinking out what really is the problem. And then typically we run a project, and sometimes there is a process that we follow. But as you can expect, with such a wide range of questions, we don't follow the same process every time. It's not like being, you know, an accountant where there's like a right and a wrong way of doing things. For us, it's more about kind of trying things and coming up with a solution, which can be frustrating sometimes, because I think everyone likes to feel that they're kind of more rooted in a direction. But on the other hand, it's quite fun because we take on problems that no one else can solve, and we think about them in brand new ways, and normally we get the answer right. So there's no typical day. That means we just kind of try things and see if they work. Yeah, well, it's quite a funky workspace, I would say, because part of the appeal of coming to somewhere like What If for a client is that they're not getting the same old thing they get from another kind of advisor. And I think we try and reflect that a bit in the space we work in. So it's a very kind of fresh workspace. We have a Spider-Man cow. There used to be a Superman cow here as well. And then when we started the New York office, that was before my time, that was about 7 or 8 years ago, the super cow was sent abroad. So he's kind of in exile now, and he's in our New York office. I've seen him there. And now we've just got Spider Cow here. So that's always a talking point with clients. And we have themed bar nights in this room as well. So one team will organize a big party for everyone, and it'll be themed. So we had one that was a nerds night, which was done by our tech team, and they had fake arcade machines set up all round. And then we've had another night, which was a kind of gypsy themed night, a kind of My Big Fat Gypsy wedding night, which was, you know, people kind of pretending they were going to a wedding, wearing kind of outrageous dresses. So we've had lots of kind of nice things that kind of, sometimes they're a bit irreverent, you know, it's quite an irreverent culture here. And it's a very values-led culture, so we have 5 core values. And most companies, those are just things that people don't really take much notice of, but here, they're really taken seriously. And, you know, our bosses, you know, the guys who founded the business, they'll go around and be kind of getting in people's faces and making jokes and stuff like that. It sounds a bit cheesy when you say it, but when you're here, it's just so much more kind of liberating, really. And that allows you to do good work. I don't think you could really do an innovation consultancy at the back of a kind of grey office with, you know, a nasty coffee machine and kind of no one joking about with each other. We have quite a lot of jokes and people take embarrassing photos of each other and send them around to everyone in the office, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's a cool place to work. I think I'm quite lucky.
Well, that was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who went to meet Jonas Twitchin. I wonder if he made that name up as well. That sounds like something he innovated. And at the end there, I think you heard the sound of a very grey coffee machine, the thing he didn't like. But you know, when Fernando goes out, he can't resist a sound effect. So anyway, that was Jonas Twitchin, who works for innovation firm What If. We're going to have some music now. We always like a bit of music at this point in the show. This is Reunion, and it's by M83. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli,
our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also our studio manager Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Menu, and that's with Mr. Marcus Hippie, who'll be doing lots of self-promotion, no doubt, but a little bit of self-promotion, promotion rather. Make sure you listen to The Urbanist. It was on yesterday. Go back and listen to it. It's on the player. It's a good thing. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be back for The Monocle Daily. And I will be back with Midori House at the same time on Monday. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.